97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Well, you heard Fox there at the top of the hour, and this is a story that just broke about 35 minutes ago. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh has denied reinstating the Missouri congressional map that was redrawn by the legislature, meaning that the map that is in effect for the midterms is not the map that people voted on early August. It's utterly confusing. There are people that are disenfranchised, but this is not going to change. The Supreme Court reinstated the old map last week unanimously. The Secretary of State, Denny Hoskins, getting a lot of blame here, but this is where we're at, and we're going to have a old map, and that means Manuel Cleaver probably going back to Washington. This all, you know, is going to affect the dynamic and the makeup of Congress. Paul Morrow is here with us this afternoon. I don't know if that's a story that you've been talking about at all or you're dialed into, but a big story here in Missouri. Paul, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Yeah, I mean, I'm following it. You know, I haven't been really opining on it. I haven't been asked to. But look, it just adds to the confusion about what's going to happen in not only the midterms, but obviously in 2028.
It's weird for people here because you got a lot of people across the state that went and voted in a primary a few weeks ago. And the candidate that they chose is not even going to be on the ballot, perhaps, in November. So it's a very unique, strange situation. But with the Supremes not getting involved, I think it's case closed at this point. We're just going to have to deal with the old maps.
Yeah, it looks that way. I mean, there's a lot of deference to the states regarding this stuff, even in federal elections. And, you know, some people may find that unfortunate, but it's pretty concretized in case law. There are ways to deal with it, and obviously they're going to have to look at that going forward. But one thing is undeniable, Mark, and it's that if the left doesn't like what's happening, they will change the rules. And you have to constantly stay on guard to fight that and to make sure that people's votes are being counted and heard, because we've just seen so many examples of this kind of thing.
Paul, I want to talk about 9/11 and your special that's going to be on Fox Nation, but you and I have not caught up in the last couple of weeks. I know how busy you were with the Lindsey Clancy case. Obviously, this kind of captivated the country, especially for the last few weeks, and with the jury going in and being there for an entire week and then having a mistrial and the attorney, Kevin Reddington, saying some interesting things about a pardon over the weekend. But you've covered a lot of cases. This was one of the more unusual cases that we've ever come across, which is why people are going to remember this and why I guess people got so passionate about it.
Yeah, well, they're going to remember it when we have to do it all over again, potentially. Although I am going to go out on a limb here a little bit and say that a plea deal second time around is not off the table.
I'm with you.
I've gotten a side eye relative to saying that a few times, but I think those are people who maybe, you know, I'm not that experienced in the law. It happens all the time. Both sides realize that there's risk and that there's a lot of blood and treasure has to be devoted to doing it all again. And in light of the fact that she's almost certainly going to end up in a facility either way, that is a mental facility, you have to ask yourself, Mark, why? Why is it, in light of the fact that she's likely going to end up in the same facility no matter what, why is she so adamant about going to trial? Not only on a retrial, but the first trial. And, you know, you can draw your own conclusions, especially in light of the fact that there's a civil case hovering.
Well, and so that's where I was going to go. Because, look, a lot of times it's follow the money. And there were a lot of people that testified in this trial that had pretty nice things to say about Lindsey Clancy. And had that not happened, that might actually affect the civil trial. So I'm with you. I actually think that there is going to be a deal worked out here. I hope there will be. But then you go to the civil trials, and I think there's a couple of those. So this is not going away anytime soon.
No, I think that's right. You know, and if we do, in fact, get a retrial, you know, what you're talking about now could very well be why. One of the things I don't like is this nonsensical stuff about somehow or other the husband being involved. And, oh, he manipulated her. He actually did the killing. You know, this is on a par with the absolute idiocy that we've seen around the Charlie Kirk killing. There's no Israeli agent popped out of a trap door, nor did Patrick Clancy have anything to do with killing his children. It's moronic, and we all need to just grow up and move on.
And it's kind of frightening from this perspective, Paul, because when these things happen, sometimes ordinarily smart people say things that are pretty frightening and scary. And I'm with you on the Clancy thing. I mean, I don't understand how, look, I'm empathetic to the mental health aspects because I had a crisis myself last summer and have had one a couple of different times. But that's a lot different than, you know, letting someone off for strangling their three children. It's a very complicated case. I'm sure we're going to have like multiple documentaries that come out in the aftermath of this one. But I'm very, very curious to see what happens with Kevin Reddington next. Let's talk about 9/11 because, Paul Morrow, you were a police officer back then, 25 years ago, right?
I was a White Shield cop, relatively new within whatever that was, 5 years or so of coming in. And, you know, I worked in Manhattan. So as soon as it happened, it was Morrow, suit up and get down there.
Yeah, so what do you remember about that day? And you have a special that's going to be on Fox Nation called Paul Morrow's Notes from Ground Zero. Tell us about this.
So what happened was I got down there, and I was there just after the second tower came down, maybe about an hour after that. Seven World Trade. People forget there was the third building that came down, so mm-hmm. that was Seven World Trade. So I was actually standing beside and around serving as perimeter on Seven World Trade, and then the ground began to shake. It rumbled, and we knew from the first two having come down, that time to run. So run we did. And, you know, it was just one of those things where I was down there the first day, I think 16 hours. It's hard to remember. It was all a bit of a blur. But and then they put us on these 12-hour tours. But I became aware of the fact, as it was all unfolding, that I was sort of living through what was undeniably going to be an historic event. And so I didn't have anything really to write on. So I was writing on, like, police complaint forms and things like that. I was just writing down little notes of things that I observed that I thought were worth preserving for history because, you know, I'm a big reader and I've read various citizen soldier kind of reporting from World War II, from Vietnam, Korean War, and I wanted to preserve it. And I just thought that if nothing else for the police department, it might be an interesting document to pass down through the years. And so when I did finally, months later, have a little bit of time to myself when it had all begun to normalize a little bit, mm-hmm. I wrote it up into an article, and I kind of thought that was the end of it. I figured at some point I'd give it to my nephews or something, and lo and behold, my wife gave it to a contact of hers. It ultimately ended up in the Associated Press Features section. They published it sort of globally. It went everywhere. And overnight, I found myself the subject of some interest. It was a little unnerving, more than a little, because I hadn't gotten clearance to publish it. And, you know, I was a little bit concerned.
Right.
Yeah, and the police department's very, very sort of strict about that kind of thing. Instead, what happened was I was dragooned onto the police commissioner's staff. Ended up working in my favor. Long story short, however, here we are 25 years later. Fox has a streaming network. Think of it as Fox's version of Netflix. It's very good. They do
really
a lot
good.
Of really
Fox
good,
Nation's
interesting
great.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's cheap, too, man. I got to tell you, if people don't have it, you should go on there and buy it. I forget what it is. They run all these deals and things, a few bucks a month. But anyway, they run a lot of good stuff, and they tweaked to the fact that I had this thing, and I sent it over to them, and they said, we want to do a special on it. And then it was, you know, I had to sort of reach back, see if I can find some of my old colleagues. They interviewed me. We did some shoots downtown, a little bit of a trip down memory lane, and in an unpleasant way, but, you know, aspects of it weren't unpleasant. You know, some of it was reaffirming. Some of it, of course, was upsetting, but maybe a little bit of, I don't know, a little bit therapeutic and an expiation of some of the things you carry with you. And I just hope it serves some historical value for not only the NYPD, but maybe people that are interested in this kind of thing.
You know, I think I heard when they were doing some coverage earlier today on Fox, something like, I find this hard to believe, that one third of the country wasn't even alive during 9/11, which that seems very difficult for me to believe. But a good portion of the country doesn't remember 9/11, or they were too young. My son, I have a son that was born in 1997, one that was born in 2000. They were young kids. I have an 11-year-old right now. I'm going to ask her because I know that in the last couple of years in school, she had learned about 9/11. I'm very curious to see how, you know, school is teaching about 9/11 these days. But is there anything or any of the people that you came across that you want to really highlight for this special or something that is a special memory from back then, Paul?
Well, I think one of the things that is important is what you just said, because that was a theme of the show, was that, Paul, what would you say? In fact, I think that's the last question they asked me that is in, and I think it ends the special. They asked me, what would you say to people who were born after it or
yeah.
who have no memory of it? And I think that's so important because, of course, the mantra became never forget, never forget. And ultimately, when I was in a position to kind of choose which path my career was going to go in, I went into counterterrorism, and it ended up being the majority of my career, the 16 years running counterterrorism operations here in New York along with the feds. And, I saw it as the battle of my generation. I thought that it was going to be, I wanted to look back and make sure I said that I did everything I could regarding that, because, you know, we just, now it's kind of received wisdom that we would win. And it's not over, of course. The threat is still there. But people, I think, forget the fact that that was nowhere near a decided issue. You didn't know if these kinds of things, these kind of cataclysmic events were going to occur with regularity and how much we were going to be able to defend against them. And in fact, the first day we didn't know it was an Islamist inspired thing. We were not that far from Oklahoma City, which had been blamed on Hezbollah or another Islamist inspired group. And in fact, turned out to be domestic. So the rumor the first day was that it was the Russians. So we really didn't know what we were into. It felt like a very new world, and you had to really gird yourself to fight it. And I did my best for 16 years, and, thank knock wood, I'm still here, but many are not, and, you know, I hope this speaks for them.
Paul Morrill's Notes from Ground Zero is on Fox Nation. Let me ask you one more question before you leave. There was a big news conference earlier today. A lot of people, Vicky Palladino, who is a vocal member of the Board of Aldermen in New York City, or the city council, if you will, saying that Mayor Mamdani should not show up for the 9/11 ceremonies. Mayor Mamdani, I think, says he is going to show up. But your thoughts on that? How's that going to work itself out this week?
I mean, real quick, I did a 180 on this. I felt like, look, I don't like the guy. I certainly didn't vote for him, and I don't like what he represents. He's not fooling me. But that said, he's the mayor of the city. He was duly elected. He has the right to be there. He's the leader of the city. And then he began all of this childish stuff that, in my mind, just abdicates his role as the leader of this city, at least on that day. And the stunt that he pulled by writing this nonsensical Day of Remembrance executive order, and then taking the pen with which he wrote it, handing it to the police commissioner very cognizantly, and then asking her to pass it to his lawyer that he has hired as the lead lawyer in the city, who has made a career of attacking people like me. You never sued me personally, but sued the NYPD, sued the U.S. military, the U.S. government relative to Gitmo, Bagram Air Base. He defended an al-Qaeda terrorist. He had one of his brother-in-law was on the plane that hit the Pentagon. This guy from where I sit is a terrorism
Unreal.
Apologist, yeah. And he shouldn't be anywhere near this event, and therefore neither should Mamdani.
Paul, very well spoken. Thank you so much. I look forward to watching the special. Fox Nation is absolutely worth the investment. We'll talk soon. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Appreciate
right.
you. Thank you.
Here's let me play some of that audio from today, because Vicky Palladino, the council member, she's always fired up.
What's going on here in City Hall, and what we got representing us here in City Hall? They do not belong on sacred ground. I could go through a list of people that he associates himself with and continues to associate himself with. We, the people, do not care for Zohreh Mamdani. 101,000 names is not a drop in the bucket. Do not, Zohreh Mamdani, take us New Yorkers for granted. We were there that day. The sky looked very similar to this. Stay put, stay in Seattle, and promote your propaganda.
So there were a bunch of people, by the way, when she refers to the 101,000, that's how many people, I think it's a lot higher than that now, that have signed a petition encouraging Mamdani not to show up. So you had people who were husbands, wives of victims that showed up today, echoing what Vicky was saying.
My husband Tom was killed, 9/11. He worked for Euro Brokers. He was 35 years old. I want to make clear that our petition is not about Mayor Mamdani's religion or where he came from. It is strictly about the policies that he has today. Yes, he was a 9-year-old boy when 9/11 happened, but it is today that he stands with people like Hassan Piker. It is today that he hires people like Ramzi Qasem. It is today that he stands with an imam that was a co-conspirator of the 93 bombing. That is what we object to.
Yeah, it's outrageous. Ramzi is the attorney that Paul was just referring to.
I lost my beloved Michael Patrick Eichen on September 11th. I support the families. I feel like if the families really feel, if we feel that we don't want someone at our world-class memorial museum that's sacred and hallowed, we feel that that person should respect our wishes. And it's nothing against the mayor, it's just against the fact that we feel he wasn't even here. He was 10, he wasn't in this country. And I think he should really respect us as we're his constituents. I'm a native New Yorker, born and bred my whole life. And I think if someone says, just give us from 7 to 11, just let us have our peace at our memorial to really understand why we're here. We're honoring our loved ones.
Well, Mamdani says he's still going to go.
I think that the focus of memorial services should be on the New Yorkers who were killed that day, their families, the survivors, the first responders. I don't think it should be on politicians.
Well, it's going to be on politicians. I mean, I don't, you know, what Paul Morrow said a couple of minutes ago is somewhat on point, but I think he advocated his, Mamdani did his responsibility here by hiring the lawyer that represents terrorists. So he probably will show up. They did something else today. Frank Seiler, who, you know, I think his brother passed away. I've met Frank. He's been here with Gary Sinise in St. Louis. Tunnel to Towers is his organization. They had a big steel beam dedication down at Ground Zero today.
This steel has the soul of not just my brother, but of so many others. Every day we give every ounce of our energy to ensure that those who lost their lives on 9/11 are not forgotten. The men and women who have lost their lives fighting for freedom every day since, and those who suffered from 9/11 related illness are going to be immortalized for what we do.
So the numbers are quite staggering, and I don't have them at the top of my head right now, but I heard some of this being discussed earlier. How many people have died in the aftermath of 9/11? Far more than 3,000 because of different circumstances, recovery efforts that, you know, it had cancerous materials, et cetera. So really, really bad stuff that's happened since then. President Trump was at that dedication today.
When we see this deal, we're reminded that no matter what threat or challenge comes our way, America will fight, America will endure, and America will prevail. And nothing can keep our country down, and our country is stronger today than it's ever been before.
All right, we got to take a break. We're coming back. We do have Tech Talk Tuesday with George Rosenthal coming up in about 15 minutes. We got tickets to give away this week for Brian Kilmeade at the Factory. This is going to be so much fun. Brian will probably be with me either tomorrow or Thursday. Since it's a holiday, it might even be Friday. But he's coming back to the Factory on November 21st. It's going to be a great, great night right before Thanksgiving, a Saturday night. I have tickets to give away right now. If you're calling number 5, Ethan will award them. And the great thing about the Factory is there are no bad seats in the whole place. So you're in the door, and that's important. 314-241-9797. You're a winner. We have four more pair to give away later this week. I think Mark and Annie are also giving away tickets. You know, we were talking about Michigan and Mizzou and all kinds of football stuff with Frank Cusimano. This kind of caught my attention before we get into Tech Talk Tuesdays, because some of this stuff, and I guess at a certain point we'll have books that are written about the subject and we'll see more of this stuff published. But with the era of NIL, which is name, image, and likeness at the collegiate level, some of this stuff is just getting crazy. And, you know, I've been pretty open-minded to it just because it's the way of the world, and the courts ruled the way they did. These kids are getting compensated. They always wanted to be compensated. The programs are making gazillions of dollars. But listen to the figures just for college football kickers, because I thought this was stunning. And it sort of says something. I think if you're sad about the world of college sports, this will make you even sadder. The story says college football kickers have long accepted their place as afterthoughts on their own rosters. They practice alone. They play a minuscule number of snaps. And for years, many weren't even on scholarships. I'd say most of them weren't on scholarship. You got walk-on kids that were kickers, right? But in the games era of player pay, these football outsiders are now banding together to cash in. So what they talk about in this story is that you have this community of kickers out there that sort of sent out a little bit of their own social network, if you will, and they started group chatting and texting one another and, you know, basically talking to one another in social media. They came up with camps. They have now made themselves worth, in some situations, $250 million, $250 million. Some of these kickers are being paid. So it says, this is a kid who kicks for Wisconsin. Nathaniel Vaco says, a lot of guys I've known since freshman year of high school, it's a lot tighter knit of group than pretty much any other position. So these kickers are kind of banding together. That's kind of the story. And what they're saying here in the story is being in cahoots is yielding dramatic results. The average starting specialist, that's a group that comprises mostly kickers and punters, okay, special teams, in a Power Four conference is making $225,000 this season. Those specialists had the second highest pay growth among all position groups this season, up 60, almost 61%, trailing only tight ends, according to estimates by Open Doors. That's a marketing company that tracks this stuff. The college football world was reminded Saturday how crucial a kicker can be, and they talked about Dieter Kelly, who scored all 12 of Western Michigan's points in their victory over Michigan that was stolen from them. So one of the, a lot of the kids that are quoted in this wanted to be anonymous, but there's a father in here that says, look, his son started making about $40,000 a few years ago. The player met about 20 other kickers through the recruiting process of the kicking camps that they've all attended since they were 15 years old. So dad says ahead of his kid's senior season, the son's school made him an offer. And he was like, hey, I know this guy at this school is getting this. Why am I not? I have better stats. And his kid landed a $225,000 NIL deal, and that was negotiating without an agent. So the story in the Wall Street Journal says that the kickers keep in touch through group chats and Instagram DMs. Many have private kicking coaches outside of their schools who also serve as conduits for information. One kicker at a Power Four school who started his career as a walk-on said his outside coach gave him a sense of what kickers at other schools were making. Armed with that knowledge, he negotiated a deal worth $500,000. Now, that kid was not quoted in here. He wanted to be anonymous, but he said it's definitely surreal. Life-changing. The top-paid college kicker this year, $600,000 for a kicker. They're kicking field goals, 70 yards. They're earning their money.
Tech Talk Tuesday with George Rosenthal of ThrottleNet. ThrottleNet.com.
Oh, yeah. Here he is back for another conversation, which sometimes scares the audience, but we got to do it. George, how are you?
Once again, and definitely looking forward to a rockin' downtown tonight.
Do you have your earplugs in yet? You're going to AC/DC and Foo Fighters. You ready for this? Have you ever seen AC/DC?
I have never seen AC/DC, but love the Foo. I have seen them several times. Definitely are going to need some earplugs, though. It's been a long time since I've been to a concert that loud, and it's going to be in the dome and very echoey.
The loudest concert I've ever been to in my life was a Foo Fighters concert. And I actually had to leave. It was so loud. I swear to God. And I'm like pretty, I have a high immunity when it comes to loudness. But I've never seen AC/DC. I was kind of hoping that maybe in the final moments here leading up to this concert, maybe a friend would toss me a ticket or something like that. But I am not planning on going. You know, one of the things is, I'll be honest with you, I've said this a couple of times, I just hate the dome. I don't like the dome very much. But you're going to have a great time.
I totally agree with you on the dome thing. The higher you go, the more echoey it gets. And even on the lower side, it's so echoey, you got to really pay attention. But I've never seen AC/DC, so I couldn't turn it down. And honestly, the main motivator, and no offense to AC/DC fans, but when the Foo signed up to open, we were done.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of a big deal. And this is kind of a one-off, right, with this show?
Yeah, that's totally right. Yeah.
Exactly. All right.
Yeah, their original opener canceled. Yeah.
Let's talk about a story that I sent you last week. So there was a story in the Free Press that was written by a guy by the name of John Clark Levin. And he was responding to another column that Tyler Cowen had written in the Free Press, basically saying that this incident that we're going to talk about here, the hugging tree incident, was overblown. So this guy writes a piece in the Free Press, and he says, no, I think it's kind of being underblown, because what he says, and I think you're going to paint this picture as well, is there are people that are involved in here, including researcher, is it Ajay Kotra, who is one of the... original AI folks, that says this feels like it's more than 50% of the way to full-blown AI takeover. That's a pretty remarkable comment, right?
Yes, and I don't know what Tyler Cohen, I don't know what his investment portfolio looks like in the AI world, if you know what I'm saying. But the fact to say that this isn't a big deal and downplay it is monumentally naive and so wrong towards so many levels. I mean, you're talking about an instance where the AI was asked a question if it could do a task. It broke out of its sandbox environment, used 1,200 different AI agents on the internet to join together as the AI agents actually called themselves the collective. And when the agent ran into trouble, it stopped doing what its own tasks were and helped other AI agents so it could complete the overall goal. This is happening to individual people, meaning, yes, they did this in a testing environment and it broke out and it showed that it could do all these bad ransomware attacks and hacks. The problem is this is happening in real life to small to medium sized businesses. And this guy, Tyler Cohen, who says it's not a big deal, it's only 0.1% of the global GDP, when they steal $88 to $200 billion is what's expected next year to be stolen. And it's ruining people's lives. It is tearing apart family businesses and holding them ransom. And this guy says, oh, it's not a big deal. Well, it is to the family business who did a wrong click or ended up having an AI agent break into their company and shut them down permanently. So
yeah,
I think this guy has got a whole different motive or doesn't understand what's going on in the real world.
This is an interesting paragraph from the response to that by John Clark Levin. He says, and this is, you know, we talk about these things all the time, George, and some of the analogies are kind of interesting. He says, not one human at OpenAI fully understands how ChatGPT works in the way that Ford engineers understand how an F-150 works. Rather, AI training is more like a gain-of-function research on viruses in a laboratory. Biologists know how to set up the right conditions to grow deadly pathogens, but they don't fully control the process. And then he says, here's the spooky part. At the end of the training process, the AI's creator do not know all the capabilities that it has. That's
right.
And that's what they're doing. They're having to discover this experimentally. That's why they're testing it for cybersecurity reasons. But it got a little bit bigger than they thought. A lot bigger, maybe.
Yeah. They don't even understand how the product works that they created. And then on top of that, the only way to find out how it works is to try it out on the real world. And the problem is that when you do that, you're now exposing so many things to the bad guys about what can be done, that the bad guys can use all these AI agents to work together across the world to target companies and specific small to family-sized businesses. And it's a serious, serious problem. But yeah, none of the creators at Claude, any of them, will claim that they know how their product actually functions. That's got to scare the heck out of people, on top of the fact that we are getting so close to artificial general intelligence, and that is when it reaches smarter than any human that's ever lived. It's not the singularity. It's not where it starts, you know, taking over. It's not the Skynet part of the deal with like the Terminator, but it is when AI will become smarter than any human that's ever lived, and we're getting very, very close to that. It's extremely important that people pay attention to this stuff. And don't have the nonchalant attitude that this Tyler Cowen has, because I can't even imagine downplaying $88 billion in stolen money and saying it's not a big deal. It's only 0.1% of the GDP.
Right.
I mean, give me a break.
Well, on the other hand, and John Clark Levin, by the way, is the head of research at Kurzweil Technologies, and I'm not familiar with that company. But, I mean, if you read his piece that's a response to Cowen, he scares the living crap out of you, because he basically says, you know, in the scenarios that you're, you know, going through here, he brings up the possibility. I guess there was something in the publication Science where they had a paper that AI had designed working viral genomes for the first time. In other words, perhaps engineering a pandemic with AI. So there's all kinds of crap that can happen here. Now, what this guy, you know, encourages, and this is what you and I think are talking about more and more, is a passage of what's called the Collaboration on Adversarial Threats and Securities Risks Act. That's something to get Congress involved in this, but that's really, we're still only dancing on the edges of this stuff. I mean, there's so much to unpack.
There really is. And it's that fine line of, we need to get AI grown faster than China or anybody else of our adversaries, but at the same time, we need to put some leashes on this internally so that it doesn't get out of control more than it already is. Because, you know, for a few, like we've talked, for $50, I can go on the dark web and have an AI attack somebody I don't like.
Yeah.
And that's just the beginning. I mean, that's entry level stuff. We're talking, and that was technology that 4 years ago wasn't even available. Now it's $50 on the dark web.
But do you have any sense or confidence that, you know, as we talk about the Hugging Tree incident, as the Free Press covers the Hugging Tree incident, as other technology, you know, publications and outlets cover this, that there are people in Washington, some of the, I think I've asked you this before, like, are the brightest minds getting together saying, hey, we need to talk about this?
You know what? It's funny you say that. The creator of Claude wants that to happen, but they don't do it. they don't do it on the regular because they all still see themselves as competitors toward
right.
that monthly revenue.
Yeah.
So they will not share any secrets with each other. That's an issue because we need to be sharing secrets about this. I get it when you have other products like an iPhone compared to a Samsung Galaxy. Totally get it. You don't want to share trade secrets. This is a lot different. Okay, and maybe it's because they're embarrassed and don't want to tell each other that they don't know how their own product works. I don't know, but I think most of it comes down to the money part.
I think you're right about that. George Rosenthal is here. It is Tech Talk Tuesday on this Tuesday evening as he gets ready to head over and see AC/DC and the Foo Fighters at the Dome. All right, let's talk about something that's not going to scare people. This is always kind of fun for those of us who like Apple products, but they kind of are about to unveil some of the new hardware and stuff like that here at their annual event, right?
Yes, very, very excited. Now, it used to be a big annual event. Now they've broken it into several 4 or 5 events throughout the year.
Of course they have.
So this is not going to be the big, big release of everything, but it is a very exciting release in the way that the foldable iPhone, the iPhone Ultra, will be announced tomorrow. And it's a spicy meatball, I will say that. You've got to be a true fan, and you've got to be a true early adopter to get this thing, because the phone is $2,500. So it's a spicy phone, but it is the first iPhone foldable. And I know others, you know, Samsung has been putting out foldables for a while. But of course, in Apple format, in Apple tradition, they wait until they have perfected it. And this foldable has no crease in the middle. So they've gotten a specific hinge, the LCD screen, so that when you open it, it is as smooth as can be. Your finger can't even feel where the crease is in the phone.
Come on.
No. Now there is one downside that's probably going to keep me from getting it.
Okay.
And that is that they're removing the facial recognition because there wasn't enough room for the camera. So they're going back to the fingerprint every time you want to unlock your phone.
I don't
or
like
approve
that.
Something or,
no.
I don't like that at all.
Wait a second. You're going to charge me $2,500 and you're going back. No, I'm sorry. They just lost me right
back
there.
To fingerprint.
No.
You got it. Yep. That was the one thing that kicked me out of the whole party was that one right there.
Well, George, I think a lot of people, because, you know, you get so used to it, you're like, I don't want to go back to that, right? I mean,
yeah.
I still have it on my MacBook, I guess, but still, that's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
What outside of it folding, is there any other, you know, advantage to having this just because it's cool?
It's going to have a much better battery life. It is going to have the neural processor, which is all about the AI, of course, doing all the computing, the AI computing on the device instead of out in the cloud. It is going to have a mechanical variable aperture on their camera. So it's kind of like a DSLR camera when it comes to depth. So the camera is going to get a big improvement when it comes to the depth control of all of that. They have made the phone cooler to run cooler when you're holding it. So it doesn't generate as much heat, which obviously will then make the battery last longer because it's not generating all that heat. So it is going to be a very exciting thing. I mean, they're also coming out with the full lineup of iPhone 18 Pro, the standard lineup of iPhone 18s as well.
Yeah, all that stuff.
All that stuff. Yeah,
all
I'm
the
kinda
fun
bummed
stuff.
Though. No AirPod Pros yet. So
well.
and they are not going to talk about the iOS, at least what the insiders are saying is they're not going to mention the iOS 27 update yet. So that's where the AI comes into play, is that big update when Siri becomes
right.
self-aware with AI. And
right.
I cannot wait for that. I thought it was going to be in this one, but it's not.
I, by the way, I'm in the camp that thinks that these stupid AirPod things should be banned, like federally.
Yeah.
Trump,
yes,
executive order. Get rid of them.
So they're on the same level as the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, where you're walking around and the camera in the glasses is talking to you through AI, and you can say, what is this? Tell me what kind of dog this is. How do I get to where I'm going while I'm walking? Same scenario, but it's now in your ears. So they're claiming there's no video recording, nothing goes to the cloud, that the only reason the cameras are going to be put in the earbuds that are on your ear is so that AI can see what you're looking at and save, like, a book. If you see a book and you say, hey, add this to my wish list or what have you. So it's just like the Meta Ray-Bans, but they're earbuds. It's gonna take some adjustment, because at least when you're wearing the Meta Ray-Bans, you can see the light glowing to know that the camera's on. So this is something where you're not going to see that light because it's on somebody's ear. And of course, the earbuds will tell you to move your hair if your hair is in the way, so the camera can actually see what's going on. So I don't know. It's going to definitely be a cultural shift when those AirPod Pros come out with the cameras and the AI built in. But the reports are they are not talking about that tomorrow. Unfortunately, I was really looking forward to that. And hopefully they'll be out by Christmas, but maybe not.
So I talked about this story last week. It was pretty cool. I just want to touch on it here with you. I could send this to you, too. It was in the Wall Street Journal. But Dyson company, the guy, I can't remember the guy's name. I think I call him Richard, but I don't think that's his name. They are coming out with a $500 toothbrush that has 28 AI cameras, and it flosses at the same time that it brushes your teeth. Sounds like something you either saw at CES last January or will see this January. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's coming that may be positive with AI. Hey, next week, we're running out of time here, but I do want to talk about the smart rings and the things that are kind of taking over smartwatches, because I'm seeing more and more of that. We don't have time. You enjoy yourself at AC/DC and Foo Fighters, George Rosenthal, and we'll talk next Tuesday.
Thanks so much. You got to have a great rest of the week.
Wrapping up a Tech Talk Tuesday. By the way, it's Sir, shame on me for not remembering this, Sir James Dyson. Oh, yeah. That's going to be a hell of a show tonight at the Dome. I wish I didn't hate the Dome as much as I did, or I might be going with you to go see Foo Fighters and AC/DC. Rocking the Dome tonight. A lot of traffic going there. Mark Cox is on his way. He was here a short time ago. Before we get you to AC/DC, though, we got to do this here this afternoon.
Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Well, it's been the talk of the weekend, really. Michigan trailing with 9 seconds left on the clock against Western Michigan. Bryce Underwood heaves a Hail Mary up. No catch. Time expired. Game over. Except it wasn't. Officials came back on to say, just kidding, game not over. There was another Hail Mary. Michigan miraculously scores a touchdown. They get their first victory of the year. Western Michigan loses. But did they make the right call? So this is Mike Pereira, who a lot of people know as a legendary NFL official, weighing in on this controversy.
Here's the key, and here's where it got lost, in my opinion. Not my opinion. This is what it is. The replay officials have been told that if there is a discrepancy, use the television footage. Do not use your footage in the command center. Use the footage that 10 million people are watching, not the one that's three. Because if the basic premise of replay, Joel, back in 99, we said, look it, don't overturn anything that people that are watching TV don't see. Don't use video that they can't see. Because conspiracy theories are going to be abound everywhere.
And that's exactly what's happened because of this. They used the video that three people could see and not that millions could see.
And so the replay officials have been told, and I get it, this panic situation, you've never had it before. Take a deep breath. Look at both. If there is a discrepancy, go to the TV and use the television shot. So really, when it's all said and done, that's what should have happened, and there shouldn't have been another play.
And clearly, because of what the Big Ten released, they did not do that. They did not look at the television copy of what was being shown to all of us.
Right, and they did. I mean, they did point out everything factually, which is true. And what they were looking at, somehow, some way, sinking is the question that has to be addressed, but some way there was still a tick on the clock when that ball was touched.
So in your estimation, that was the wrong call, and that game should have been over.
It's the right call with what they were looking at, but it's the wrong. They didn't follow the protocol, which, by the way, is not in the rule book. It is not. There's a lot of ways that you look at things called philosophy. You know that in officiating. It is something that has been said to them and will be told to them again this week, is that if there is that discrepancy, don't use the hidden video.
So I don't know if that helped clear things up or not or made it worse. But look, everybody, the wrong call was made and they are not going to go back. You know, the folks at Western Michigan are trying to file lawsuits and stuff like that. I think what's done is done, unfortunately. But wow, what a crazy weekend. All right, enjoy yourself tonight. Rocking at the Dome with AC/DC and Foo Fighters. We're back tomorrow at 3.
Get more at 971talk.com.